From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. Today I talk to Sean Nam, who is the CTO of IV Energy. We talk about the ups and downs of supporting our founders during fundraising. We talk a little bit about Uber and what Travis Kalanick went through. We talk about Apple, we talk about Steve Jobs, and then we go off on a tangent about the American democracy through the eyes of a South African and a Korean. So really hope you enjoy the show. Cheers. Sean, welcome to the CTO Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Do I say Sean or Sean?
Sean.
And is it Sean Nam?
Yep.
Sean, what do you think of the Apple Vision Pro?
It's hard to say. I haven't experienced it myself, so I'm holding judgment. I think it's a bold attempt at something. It shows Apple's hardware prowess. They have a ton of tech in there. But I think, you know, like the iPhone, it might take some time, or it might be like Apple's attempts into video games a long time ago. So I think it's early. I'm excited that they're trying something very different. I think it's been a long time. For me, Apple products have gotten boring over the past couple years, decade. So I'm excited that they're trying different. They're pushing the VR and AR kind of industry forward in a sense that only they've done in other industries. So I'm excited. I think the product itself is, you know, you kind of have to see it for what it is and have some expectations and temper those expectations.
Yes. It's always fun for me to listen to the people who actually have them and pontificate about things I just don't relate to. I'll never forget when I first touched the iPhone, just the responsiveness on the screen was an emotional response I felt.
Yeah, I remember Coverflow, which was how they showed the music on the music app. The album covers when that was a thing.
The thing that's similar for me, I also haven't put on a Vision Pro, but I remember I was fairly late to getting, I got an iPhone, the first iPhone, but I think it was a couple weeks of just listening to the press and, you know, of course, YouTube wasn't that big back then. So you didn't have all these reviewers, you know, and it was. So I remember reading about it and people saying familiar things to me like they do today about the Vision Pro, just how shockingly accurate the tracking is and the brain being tricked in certain ways. I'll never forget people talking about the iPhone, holding it in your hand and how it feels, until I actually had one in my hand and I touched it and I scrolled it and I was like, man, this is, like I said, I'm having this tactile emotional response in my body, sort of expecting the same thing to happen with the Vision Pro or maybe the Vision SE.
Yeah, it's an interesting name. I don't know what they're going to call the regular, you know, do they just call it the Apple Vision? Like, it's interesting. They don't usually start with a pro model. So it's very interesting marketing.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be expecting the Vision, the Apple Vision, I suppose, for the common layperson.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about, you're the CTO of IV Energy. What does IV do?
So we're on a mission to change how people think about and use shared energy. So the way we're tackling that is through our solar platform targeted at multifamily buildings and multifamily tenants. So what our platform does is collects data, energy data from the solar systems on low-rise apartment complexes. We combine that with utility data that we collect at the individual meter level, and we apply our algorithm to give everyone the savings that more accurately represents their usage and all the different aspects. So our theory is if you use more energy during the day, maybe you're working from home, then you should save more because that's when the solar production is highest. So we're applying that concept, taken into a variety of different ways, and that's our platform. And we target multifamily companies, so real estate portfolio companies, property managers, and our end users are the tenants themselves.
Hmm. So the tenants would benefit from, is it a time of use system?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. We do take into account the time of solar production, time of use in terms of consumption, and in terms of the shared savings, what the total pie was.
Yeah, so you have a multifamily home, you have solar panels on there, multifamily building, I suppose, and then each tenant gets to benefit from the solar panel, and it's tied to their usage.
Exactly.
And the technology platform system that you've built to manage that, is it are you an IoT company?
We are a software as a service company. Right now, we manage the software fully for our clients, so very white glove service. And we're using the platform internally to generate our deliverables, which are the numbers, the metrics, and the savings for the tenants.
Do you grab that information from sensors, or is there an API, that the common interface that these hardware providers provide?
Most of them have an API, and that's what we're using. We tend to be brought into projects early on, especially with new constructions. It really depends on when we get brought in, but we like to recommend specific hardware vendors have great software support. And that's for the solar production side. And for the utilities, we use, they have smart meters installed in most of these places. So there's services out there that are aggregating that, providing that to us as a service.
Great. How large is your team?
So we have 8 engineers, and we're expanding our product management team to 4 product managers. And we have 3 data analysts helping out as well.
Great. And what are some of your learnings as the CTO of 10, 12-person team?
Team dynamics, I think it's been a big one. We're a startup. We advertise that in our job listings and in our interview process. So team dynamics and team balance of skill sets across different team members. So we have people very strong in data analysis, and then we have people very strong in the industry with a good amount of experience in data analysis. So it's a balance of using everyone's skill set to their maximum potential and for the right projects. And with 12 people, right, you have a very limited pool. You have many different projects, many requests coming in. It's a balance of which ones do we tackle and who is tackling them. Oftentimes, you're working just by yourself or one other person. So it's been a balancing act.
Got it. Yeah. And are you managing fundraising? Are you guys funded? Are you bootstrapping, or what's happening?
Yeah, we just closed our Series A. I'm not allowed to disclose other details beyond that, but we did close the big round. That'll get us through next 2 years or so, is the plan.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite books. You mentioned here The Modern Software Engineering by Dave Farley. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. So I found Dave Farley through his YouTube channel. He talks a lot about software engineering and agile principles and different modern techniques of development. And he wrote a book on modern software engineering. And he takes the approach of comparing software engineering, what we do as developers and engineers, to other disciplines. He talks, compares it to, it's a common comparison to, to compare to civil engineers or architects. So he takes a very scientific approach, tries to look at the data, looks at what other fields do, and tries to capture what is what we're doing engineering, and if so, where do we go from that? And if not, how do we approach our discipline in a more engineering fashion and what the benefits of that would be? And he shares some interesting stories and lessons that other disciplines, other engineering disciplines can take from software engineers and vice versa. Some of the stories he tells about other engineering disciplines and what they think of software is very interesting. It's interesting to get a different perspective from other technical people.
Yes. Were you born in Korea?
Yeah.
How did you come to the States?
When I was little, my parents, both of them did their master's and PhDs in the US. So they brought myself and my sister along.
Great. And then how did you get into becoming a CTO?
It wasn't planned. It was a right place, right time type of moment. I joined Ivy as a software developer under a senior engineer. We both worked on the very first MVP and turn of events, and I was left kind of holding the keys to the kingdom, if you will. And so running away from that challenge, I really embraced it, built a team around me, and just try to continue to grow, look at the bigger picture always. And that's what I do kind of day to day out, or at least I strive to.
Yeah, that's awesome. The idea of joining a company as a software engineer and then becoming the CTO is quite a story. How did you handle that?
It was very tough. How did I handle it? I think it was a lot of support and belief in me from the two co-founders. A lot of support. I found this community through one of the consultants I was working with at the time. That person referred me and I found 7CTOs. So it's been a huge support mechanism for me, talking with other technical people, other more experienced leaders, and really taking their lessons and trying to apply them.
Yeah. What are some of the lessons that you're learning?
A lot of it is people management. We talk a lot in my forum about the role of the CTO in relation to the CEO and the C-suite, especially in a startup. We have a very visionary founder and CEO. Part of my role is managing his expectations, his vision, applying that vision into the product, building that product. And I think we say manage a lot, but it's a whole process of trying to balance his needs, my needs, and the team's needs, and all that in the context of reality of we only have so many people, we only have so much time, and we only have so much money. So everything's against us, and it goes back to balance on how do you use the resources you have effectively and communicate that effectively.
Yeah, no, that is a big challenge. I definitely get that. I think it's somewhat disappointing sometimes when we get into this role and we realize that it's not really about our software development skills anymore.
Yeah.
Sean, what do you want to talk about, man?
I've been thinking a lot about venture capital and the founder's relationship with the board and the investors. Someone recommended I read, I think it's called Founders versus Investor. I got through about a couple of chapters, but I think it's a interesting relationship, especially now that kind of the bubble has burst in terms of that zero interest rate. And I got into this book actually because I was watching Super Pump, The Battle for Uber. It's based on a book. It's now a Showtime series. And I've heard some of the stories and some of the challenges that they had culturally and otherwise. But the Hollywood version of it was very interesting to live through because stepping back and reflecting on my experience and seeing what my CEO is going through, I don't think it's far from reality. That's kind of the fascinating part is I'm sure they took some creative liberties and you know, it's the book is probably secondhand accounts, but it captured the insanity of the craziness that happened. They portray him, Travis Kaepernick, as being rash and young and excessive, and I'm sure some of that is true, but at the same time, from his perspective, you see the vision and his drive to make that vision a reality. And a lot of that, for better or for worse, I see that in my CEO. And I think Some of it is resilience. Some of it is stubbornness. You see from the lead, one of the lead characters and investors in Uber from Bench Capital, forgot the investor's name, but he's trying to give advice on how to run the company, how to grow, on what to do and not to, how to manage other investors. Some of it was hers, some of it wasn't. And in the end, it kind of, that relationship blew up in a negative way. So, and with our fundraise, you know, I saw some of that, not necessarily to that extent, but trying to find an investment partner that really understands our industry and our challenges and really is bought into the vision and is wanting to be a long-term partner. So it's a lot of interesting dynamics. Everyone has their own agenda that they need to meet, right? You know, when an investor firm sends a partner to talk with a founder, you know, they have a number that they need to meet or their own red lines internally. So it's just interesting to see all that play out, both in that series as well as the stories that this book is telling and sharing.
I really enjoyed watching that show. I couldn't help but feel a sense of sadness because it's a tool that I benefit from all day, every day. And yet the show presents him as borderline, you know, obviously obsessive. And I do wonder about founders going into that state of just irrational belief, which oftentimes you hear that said about Steve Jobs as well, the reality distortion field.
Right. I think this is where really the people around the founder, around the visionary, I think that's where it really makes a difference. If you look at Steve Jobs, often we don't talk about Steve Wozniak, who, you know, a lot of the engineers like to point at and say he made the first prototypes of the Apple One and the Apple Two, but they had a relationship that worked for them. And later on, it was Johnny Ives who came in with the design perspective, and then they built a whole team around the engineering. So I think, again, and this is part of my fascination with this, is because in a software product, it's really the CTO that's having to make this vision a reality in the technical aspect of it. It comes back to your relationship with the CEO and how you present what's possible and what's not possible and what's possible now versus what's possible later. I like to say with software, there's very little limits on what we want to do. So it's really about what the business wants to do. And that kind of goes into the role, is this is a business role. Engineers will build anything you ask them to. They're very smart people, but it's about building the right things at the right time, the right way. And getting all those three things aligned is constant challenge, and very few have done it successfully.
How has fundraising impacted you?
It's really forced me to look at the business from a business perspective. When you do angel money, a first venture, there's expectations, you know, with venture capital, especially software as a service, there's expectations on growth, on trajectory. From a technical aspect, there's also all the kind of the legalities of things comes into play. So a lot of the due diligence I helped with was around what kind of open source license do we use, right? And I may not be directly deciding, is this okay? You know, I'll turn that over to the legal team, but you know, I have to be very cognizant of what tools we use and how we're using them. And it's been, for me personally, a lot of it is with AI. I've been struggling because it has a lot of potential, but at the same time, there's a lot of risk with information, with data, with privacy, and not just from a privacy perspective, but also from a compliance perspective. We work with our clients and their data, so we're kind of on the hook, versus if we were directly selling to an end user and we're a more consumer-facing product, right? So there's a lot of consideration having to navigate what risks are acceptable, what do we have to see in terms of return to take that risk. It's really putting on my business hat, which I enjoy. It's challenging in a different way.
And I imagine with all that risk and unknowns, the fundraising activity wants certainty, predictability. They want algorithms. If I put in $1, do I get my $10? And for the founder, of course, everything exists and everything is amazing. But now here you come as CTO and it's like, well, I don't know, man.
Yeah, that's a really good way to capture that feeling. But I've been told engineering, product engineering will always be one step behind kind of the sales and marketing. And for a startup, that's actually great because that means we're selling a future and a vision that people are buying. So at times, often it will butt heads with how we sell it, how we market it. But at the end of the day, if people are paying for this vision, it's on me to deliver that vision.
Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today.
How has fundraising impacted you?
It gives me perspective, especially with the venture capital market where it is right now and interest rates. How I look at the CEO and the founder really changed for me is because it takes a lot of effort and belief in the thing to get belief from someone else in you and your product and your vision. So it's given me a lot of perspective on how different people are looking at things and the words we use to share the vision. And at what point do you say they don't get it? I think we've had a few of those kind of, we know early on it's not a good fit in terms of investor.
Would you say you're a changed person pre and post series?
I don't know if I can delineate at that level. I would say I'm a different person from when I took on this role, like before being a software engineer versus a CTO or in a leadership, in any type of technical leadership role. I've had to really work on communication skills. You know, I thought I had really great skills, but I've learned the hard way that there's always room for improvement, which I'm not against. It's just learning where you are in different environments, it was a lesson for sure. And the other thing, and I got this advice a lot in the beginning of my transition, when you're a manager or a leader, in a leadership type role, you don't get feedback instantly as you would as a developer or a software engineer. The whole agile mantra or, you know, everything around development processes these days is about feedback. You know, how quickly can we get the feedback, whether it's from the code and passing tests or whether it's from our customers and seeing whether this is valuable for them. So all of that, that's what I've been told. And, you know, that's what I was experiencing, that's what I had experience with. And then you turn to leadership and people management and it's not there. There's principles to guide you, but there's no set structure because people are not computers, right? Everyone's different. And it's hard to, you have to kind of navigate as things come up and really respond to the situation. It's not as prescriptive as saying be agile and, you know, do sprints. It's not as straightforward sometimes.
Yeah, I'm surprised at how hard the communication thing is. I'm also surprised at how hard it is to receive feedback. Or even give feedback.
Yeah, I've learned that as well. It's one thing to look at code and give feedback in a PR kind of environment. It's a whole different thing to give feedback on an individual when you know what you say will impact how they approach their work, how it may impact their future at your company. So it's definitely, I think, has much bigger impact. And trying to use the right words and trying to express your message in an informative and helpful way, I think that's a challenge. Last year, this time, I actually did a 360 leadership review. This was the first of any of us that we've done. It was, for me, it was very eye-opening. I really love it because it lets you get into the minds of others and what they think of you and your work in a very structured and safe environment. So I'm looking forward to doing that again this year, and hopefully we can expand that process to more of the leadership group.
Very good.
Thank you.
I want another Seanism.
All right. I'll share something I saw the other day on the news. So we work with solar utilities, and here in California, we often complain about the three big IOUs, SDG&E, PG&E, and SC&E. I learned about out in West Virginia, one of their IOUs was caught in a bribery scheme. And the only part of the investigative journalism piece was that the only reason they could get away with such explicit bribery was that no one was paying attention. And I think this is a lot of things we're facing right now in society. It's a lack of interest and a lack of education, even with solar, seems so simple. You can look up how it works. You install it on your home, and it's great. But there's a lot of complexities and policies and with the utilities, and it takes a long time for those systems to go online and be integrated into the broader grid. So the moral of that story was, one, they were caught. Two, the community really stood up and said this was not acceptable, and they got the rates the IOU was proposing. It was like $100K worth of rate increases, and they got that cut in half. That only came because people were showing up and people were paying attention and they understood the process. And I think we take education and just awareness for granted. I know there's a quote about, in a democracy, the most important thing is a well-educated electorate. I think that's comes with anything. When the public is unhappy, well, you're partially unhappy because you've let it go for so long. So, and out here in San Diego, there's similar efforts to replace one of the IOUs and hopefully have a more fair or more transparent at least system. So really, with 2024 being an election year, I think it's important that people pay attention to the issues and speak their voice, whether it's in an election or whether it's something as small as going to your town hall meeting and saying this is unacceptable. And I think we've lost that activism. I think we've been so, we're either jaded or distracted.
Yeah, I think the distracted is a phenomenal insight. Because as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, you and I are both immigrants, and participating in the American democracy, to me, is complicated. I'm a well-educated person as far as the school system and being fellow CTOs. The challenge I have is the amount of work I have to do to participate in the democracy. When you get that book in the mail and it's all the propositions and it's the, then you read the for proposition and you're like, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And then you read the against and you're like, oh yeah, this makes a lot of sense. You know, I sometimes think that I wish we could find a system of government that didn't require people to be educated people. Because here's what I'm saying is, my need to be governed / live in a safe environment, be able to raise my family, be able to do what I want to do, does not require of me to be educated.
I still need to be governed. I still need to be in a social system. So why make voting and why make it so hard for me to understand what I should vote for?
I think that's the flaw in the system. It's just historical. And I will say, for example, Korea is a much younger recent nation state. And when I was living there, it was very easy to vote. And I know this is the case in other countries as well. They've streamlined their systems so that it's not a hassle. And I think for the US, for a variety of reasons, we haven't really moved past the original system that was set up. And that's where people are either jaded or distracted by all the other things going on.
I think the distracted word is a brilliant insight, because I have wondered, why am I not at town hall meetings and why am I not making my voice heard? And but I see such futility as an outsider to the American system. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm just saying, sharing sort of from a vulnerable place, that participating in the system is hard. When I get done working, I'm exhausted. I'm not going to page through a telephone book sized information pamphlet about each proposition. I'm mentally exhausted. And then it's not written in a way, and I hope GPT will fix this probably, but it's not written in a way that I can actually understand. You know, I can understand it, but it requires exceptional comprehension skills to understand those 50 paragraphs. And then when you read it, it doesn't take a few sentences to realize that it was written with a certain bias, that they're not trying to inform you, they're trying to convince you. So as someone who is a logical deductor, calculator, complexity machine, I can read the for and I can read the against, and I can see merits in both arguments. I am a highly educated person. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm tired. I'm really, really exhausted. Now, to participate in the democracy, okay, you could say, listen, dude, stop being tired. You're part of a democracy. Buck up. Go and do your work. Well, now it's even harder to do when I realize that my neighbors and my neighbors' neighbors and the masses are actually, they are not reading through these propositions. They are not reading up on the candidates. They are, you know, sorry, you got me on my soapbox. But you know what is hilarious for me? What I find hilarious, again, as a South African driving around in the United States, I've been here for 20 plus years, so I'm an American citizen, so I'm not complaining. But what is so hilarious for me is that the extent of canvassing is literally some person's name on a placard on the side of the road. I'm like, okay, Doug Anderson, great. Now Doug Anderson is next to Stacy Smith, next to so-and-so. It's dumb.
Yeah, I had someone recently say, politicians are just famous actors. And I think politics has turned into a show. I think that's partially what you're feeling. I feel you. I'm exhausted at the end of the day as well. We use our brains. I had someone else comment, I don't think unless I get paid to. You know, he was a fellow CTO. But I think that's where the system, I think this is a systematic issue that as individuals we can try, but I think unless we group together and recognize that this is not a me or you issue, this is how do we get everyone involved? Just looking at history, that's when you see the big movements. And I think people don't do that. They're just stuck to their phones and, you know, they'd rather be in their little virtual worlds instead of outside talking to real people.
Yeah. Again, your word distraction resonates so deeply with me. It's a political system of distraction.
Yeah. And I think that's why we haven't seen a lot get done the past couple of years. For me, who has been here probably 2/3 of my life, it's really disappointing, really, to see all this history and all the effort people have put into this country, and it's kind of wasted so much potential. We talk a lot about being a beacon of democracy, and yet our democracy is, you know, people yelling at each other and, you know, right, signs posted, and, you know, that's all we get. It's really disappointing.
Yeah, I think that is the other D word that is very real, is the disappointment. It is disappointing that this is what's happened. Two octogenarians competing for the presidency. It really is laughable. Like you said, the beacon of democracy has iterated to this point. And I think for you and me as immigrants, it's tough. I'll just reflect on this. You know, in South Africa, one of the ways in which the white government would manipulate the black masses was to prevent them from being educated. Kids would get to elementary school, primary school, and then sort of fall out of high school. And so you have a system that rewards highly educated people that also keeps a very large majority of people uneducated. Pretty simple way of building an inequitable system.
Yeah, I think it's a very common tactic. You keep information out. You look at the few governments around the world that have, that are autocratic, and, you know, that's what they do. They keep the information out. Some of them use the education system in their benefit to teach, you know, misinformation.
So you take that approach, and then you make participating in the democracy one of educated people, so that they can understand what the F you are trying to promote in your proposition. It's really very disappointing. You know, Sean, this was a very, very sad conversation. Thank you. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I appreciate it. What did you get from this?
I had a good time. I think I finally relaxed, so I appreciate the encouragement.
Absolutely, man. Well, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for chatting with me. I look forward to seeing you soon again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I had a lot of fun.
Okay, Sean, take care.
Thank you.
That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.